The following program is pre-recorded.
Hello, everyone. This is Jerry Pippin, and today we have a program that is very, very intriguing. It's about UFO disclosure and black ops. Tonight, we'll be talking about UFO disclosure, and we'll be going behind the scenes to investigate some deep black projects. That's the way they refer to them, usually. To maybe shed some light on the deep black projects and UFO disclosure, we have Navy veteran Dan Willis. Willis had experiences with black projects and also the UFO phenomenon. Dan, by the way, appeared in the Disclosure Project press conference at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. He was witness number 6. From the West Coast, we have Dan Willis. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Jerry, good to be on the show.
Dan, now you were one of the witnesses back in May of 2001 for the Disclosure Project. Is that right?
That's correct. I was at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., along with 20 other witnesses. Yeah, it's an interest to me what gets out on the media. I used to be an ABC newsman, a broadcast engineer for many years, and it really interests me that, you know, what was disclosed at the press club. My witness testimony, I just want to preface, say that compared to the other witness testimonies, which have the supporting documentation and the explosive evidence and testimonials that were brought, was, you know, insignificant, but it collaborated. My witness testimony specifically, I was in communications with the Navy at the Naval Communication Station in San Francisco, which in 1969, I received a message from a Navy ship off the coast of Alaska reporting a off Port Bow, a brightly glowing reddish-orange elliptical saucer coming out of the ocean. And the ship's crew visually saw this, and the radar operator tracked it as it came out of the ocean and shot off into space, and he tracked it going over 7,000 miles per hour. This was a priority level message that was classified as secret, going to Chief of Naval Operations in Washington, D.C. The other witness testimonies revealed, you know, alien bases on the other side of the moon, NASA airbrushing the photos out before they go to the public, Captain Salas, the nuclear launch officer, where 16 nuclear tipped missiles were shut down and the guards were with the weapons drawn and the glowing red UFO outside the base. He had all the official documentation from the Office of Special Investigations of the Air Force. John Callahan, who was the third highest in the FAA during the Reagan administration, they had 31 minutes of a large, four times the size of the Japanese 747 going over Alaska, which the admiral threw together a meeting, swore everybody to secrecy, had to give all the information to the CIA that he had, but he had all the backups of everything, and he brought all that with him. So many of the witnesses had supporting documentation, all 20 of us. And what was revealed to the 22 cameras that were in the back row at the National Press Club was that our legal government is being denied access with proof of, from two presidential administrations. There's no legal oversight on these unacknowledged black robe projects taking in hundreds of billions of dollars a year. We have witnesses involved in targeting and shooting down the extraterrestrial craft and retrieving them. The ET civilizations have not shown any hostility but have shut down our nuclear weapons. And they have technologies, and we have the scientists willing to prove this, that could end the energy environmental crisis that's been hidden in these projects. And after I was on CNN, Headline News, CBS special assignment team came down to interview me, and I said, look, I'm not going to do this interview unless I can say that we have the scientists willing to come forth in an open congressional hearing that can prove that we have a solution to the energy crisis and these technologies that, you know, essentially no moving parts, they don't wear out, it would decentralize power, you know, it's just technology has been hidden for over 50 years.
Did the CBS people agree?
Oh, they agreed, yes. She said absolutely, you know, we'll do that. She was on the phone in tears to me saying, I'm sorry, the Hyrax cut that part out.
So, Dan, I think of you as one of our own, a former newsman, former broadcast engineer, and they censored you. Is this the only time you've been censored?
No, I have multiple experiences with it. After we did the National Press Club, Jerry, we went on Capitol Hill, met with two dozen senators, congresspeople, and gave this information. And CNN, CBS, all the major networks, basically I shared with you what was disclosed at the press conference, but what they aired to the public was that we wanted to have hearings on the reality that UFOs are real, which of course is not going to gain any government or public interest. So what Dr. Greer decided to do was to go city to city and rent these big halls, have a few thousand people in, and we'd show the executive briefing video. It's about 1 hour long that shows all the testimonies and how basically our government has essentially been infiltrated by these illegal rogue operations in order to secure their vested interests. And so I toured with them on the whole western United States. I was in Colorado, San Diego, L.A., San Francisco, Eugene, Portland, all across the West Coast. Without exception, every single media that went in San Diego was dancing alien dolls. In San Francisco, they were saying, oh, the Disclosure Project looking to aliens to solve the world's energy problems, In Portland, they were smirking and giggling to each other, and they were saying, UFOs, aliens, come on, let's get on with the big story. This week the Bozos meet the Broncos in the playoffs, it was like that, consistent throughout the entire media.
And we've all seen that kind of coverage on the media, especially on television, but why do you think that happens? Is it just that these reporters have been conditioned to report UFOs with a smirk and a laugh and a joke, or could it be more sinister? Could there be orders coming down from the top, like you alleged originally?
Yeah, both factors are true, Jerry. We have been conditioned with the little green man giggle factor. It's an uncomfortable subject because people don't know how to approach or even talk about it, because we've been, indoctrinated with all the movies, about evil aliens coming down and all this. But there's more to it.
And you bring up an interesting point, evil empire type things, ETs that need our blood, eat cows and humans and mutilate them. And is that the true story, or is it the other story that I get from Dr. Greer, that it's, they're people of light and understanding and wonderful, intelligent beings who just want the best for us?
Well, it would, I have not met any of these, but I would say, judging by the evidence, that if they can travel with the technology that they have, is thousands to maybe, hundreds of thousands of years in advance of us. Look how we've expanded our technology in the last 100 years. If they have gone that far, I would imagine anything that they could use for weaponry against us would be, like going up against Genghis Khan with a firecracker, as one of our witnesses once said. We wouldn't be having this conversation. If they wanted to be hostile, if they wanted to take over our planet, if they wanted to do us in, it wouldn't be a very difficult task with their advanced technology as they would, have developed it.
So you really don't think there are any E.T. bad boys, so to speak? I mean, you don't think there's an E.T. threat?
Absolutely not. I do not believe that.
No, the reason I ask you, Dan, is, I'm not the only guy that thinks this, that perhaps after the terrorism card is played and they made all the money they can off terrorism, the next big moneymaker will be the E.T. threat. We'll have to gear up for that. Or am I being too cynical?
No, you're being precisely correct. In fact, one of our witnesses, Carol Robson, was a spokesperson for Dr. Wernher von Braun. He said this is back in the 70s, you know, he was saying, well, first there's going to be Soviets, rogue nations, then we'll have to build a multi-trillion weapon system in space for terrorists, and this is, you know, way back when, and then he spoke of asteroids, and he said the final card, and he would say this over and over and over again to her, the final card is the alien card, where we'll have to build this weapon system in space to fight aliens, but it's all a lie. If you look at the movies that we watch of all, you know, Independence Day, you know, War of the Worlds, Signs, we have all this subconscious conditioning of, you know, evil aliens, you know, coming to take over our planet. When in fact, what they have demonstrated is that they're very concerned about our hostility and our use of nuclear weapons.
Well, on the nuclear question, Dan, lots of evidence that the ETs have intervened.
Yeah, that's how the whole thing came about, Joe. You know, when we started blasting our first nukes back in 45, you know, our witnesses, we have multiple of witnesses that worked at nuclear facilities, and they were, UFOs were buzzing all around, you know, White Sands and that whole area. And that's how what happened was the high-power radar was interfering with the craft and, you know, caused these crashes. And then what happened was, you know, the military did what military would do, you know, would make it a classified project because they needed to discover what technology we could use against our adversaries here on this planet. So,
Dan, are you still with Dr. Greer? I mean, are you guys working together?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Okay. Well, working with my, I don't make any money. I'm involved with, you know, a number of witnesses and things involved in the disclosure project. But I'm not I'm just basically speaking on my own. I feel concerned because, you know, when I was a kid, I was thinking, you know, gee, in the future, we'd be able to, you know, maybe go to other planets and not have to drive gasoline cars. We'd have anti-gravity and technology. We've done a lot with computers and things, but there are certain technologies that have just stayed retarded, you know, for many decades. And, you know, as Ben Rich, the head of Lockheed Skunk Works, says, you know, that in the Black Projects, you know, anything you can imagine, you know, if you're talking faster than light, teleportation, anything you can see in these science fiction movies, they have, as hard as it is for us to conceive, already developed and have this other world going on behind. And, you know, how this whole thing happened is back in 1954, when, as General Lovkin, one of our witnesses stated, that Eisenhower was basically taken out of the loop, because when they discovered that this technology was ripe to be able to be released to the world for the good of mankind, the corporations, which are owned by some of the wealthiest people in the world, who also have vested oil interests and heavily, you know, involved into the industrial military complex, saw that this was going to be, you know, it's almost like the movie Inconvenient Truth, where you know, he's looking at the world versus all this gold. Okay, well, we could save the planet or make all this gold. Let's see, what do we do? Give up this multi-trillion-dollar oil industry, or do we release this to the world? So what they cleverly did was, back in 54, is created unacknowledged special access projects where even the president gets denied access. And they have their operatives operating within our
government. You know, for the life of me, I can't figure out how they got away with that or get away with it. I mean, I know lots of politicians. If you're a politician, you run for president, you got to have a big ego. And I don't think you'll sit around and let somebody tell you, hey, it's not up to you. You can't know. If I were president, that guy wouldn't be here tomorrow that told me that. He'd be fired. Do you think it is that maybe they just don't even know to ask the right questions?
Well, no, that's a great question. It happened with Carter, exactly what you're saying. He had a UFO experience. He inquired to his CIA director, who was George Bush Sr.
I know that story, and Papa Bush actually told Jimmy Carter to go take a flying leap only on the last day of his office. You know, Carter immediately replaced Bush. There's some evidence even that that the Clintons know more than you might think, with the Rockefeller Initiative and things like that back in 95. And there is evidence that he asked Hubble, the attorney general at the time, to find out. And the story was they told Hubble they weren't going to tell him, and Clinton didn't take that for a no, I don't think. I think there's more there than we know so far. Can't prove it, though.
Well, you know, Jerry, everything looks confusing from the outside. When you look at it, things don't make sense. The movies don't match the subtitles, as you could say, you know. But when you understand the agenda, you understand how the secret government...
Oh, yes, the secret government. The shadow government. MJ-12. Illuminati. We could go on and on. Dan, I'm not really making fun of the idea that there is a secret cabal or government running things. Let's talk about that when we come back. You've got to take a break, okay?
Own the book that has unraveled and shaken the UFO and alien research establishment to its core. Already called An Incredible Book and An Incredible Story by George Norrie of Coast to Coast AM, UFO Highway offers the most explosive look at the most infamous underground base in the world, Dulce. Critically acclaimed author and researcher Anthony F. Sanchez breaks down the secret underground base and gives readers the innermost glimpse of the secretive military-industrial complex and the forbidden alien agenda. Learn how Sanchez explains the origins of humanity with startling proof, detailing how off-world intervention has been the cause for humanity's rapid and exponential growth in technology. As time draws down, are you prepared for the truth? Order this incredible, eye-opening book today at www.ufohighway.com. That's www.ufohighway.com.
Dan Wallace is our guest from the West Coast. Dan and I are talking about the secret government, a parallel government, a black operation. Even our elected officials don't know about a lot of it. That's what they say. And Dan, you're saying it all started back in 1954.
Well, if you were to picture something, Jerry, imagine you're in 1954 and you're in a top secret compartment of meeting. Oh, the scientists bring a box, and this box says, well, this device here has no moving parts. It produces unlimited amount of energy, no pollution. What should we do with this, you know?
Dan, it sounds like the Ark of the Covenant.
Yeah. And so this whole thing, there's a lot of what you're talking about is exactly what's going on. There's a lot of frustrated, pissed off people in very high places and very powerful places that have no access to this, such as the head of Joint Chiefs of Staff,
Here we go again, Dan. I was in the military. You were too. When you get to be a general officer, one of the top dogs, you have that ego, the same thing the politicians have. I just don't think they would... I don't understand how they put up with somebody telling them they can't know something.
Well, for example, this whole thing came about, the Disclosure Project came about, because Clinton had an inquiry into his CIA director, you know, to find out about this. And when... he brought Greer in because he was frustrated. What he said to Dr. Greer was, you know, I know this is real. I'm trying to find out why the hell I can't gain access to it. And this has been the repeated story to many people. And how they did this was they infiltrated our national security apparatus.
You're saying back in 1954 this happened?
Correct. In that time frame. And you remember Eisenhower before he left office. You know,
yeah, the famous military-industrial complex.
Powers and all that. Mm-hmm. So what they have is they have their agents and operatives. When people say, oh, the government's keeping it from us, well, it's not our government. Most of our government's clueless, you know, about this. It's their operatives that are in there. And, you know, we have, if you go to disclosureproject.org, there's a CIA document back in 91 that, you know, basically says they have relationships with every single news media wire service that they can spin or kill a story in the interest of national security. Now, and we also have a document from Daniel Sheehan, our legal counsel, of 42 CIA NSA operatives that are in high executive media positions. That's rather an old document, I'm sure it's more now, that whose main job is to oversee this. So,
well, now you're talking about something I understand. I've been in the media all my life. And if you pay people in the media just a little bit more than they can get anyplace else, you more or less own them. I'm pretty upset about what has happened to the media. I just don't understand how they co-opted everybody. But it appears they have.
Well, you're a perfect person to talk about this because, one, you've been in the military and you understand chain of command. And you also have been in media for a long time. So you're a perfect person to discuss all this about. And as you know, with a chain of command, and with a compartment of classified operations, you have to have a need to know.
Well, I must say the need to know factor does work pretty well. Two people can be in the same room and not know what each other
are
doing.
And they, you know, people will give the argument, well, you know, it would have leaked out by now if this is true. Well, the truth is, it's been leaking out all over the place.
You're right about the smirk factor, or you sleight of hand, you change the subject, or you get to a hot button issue, or you cover it up in many ways. They've really got this down to a science on how to divert people's attention.
They have many, many strategies. You know, you have people that are very official authorities come out and make
I'm dumbfounded
statements.
About how the psychology works. I mean, it seems to work every time.
Oh, you know, the night before I went to Washington, Jerry, I was tossing and turning before getting on the plane. I said, my God, what am I getting involved in? You know, this is going to be, if this thing gets out all over the whole media, it's going to change everything. And everything as we know with government and everything. And so in this dream I had, I imagine everybody gave their testimony, and then at the end, the secret government operative, or whatever you want to call them, came up and discredited everyone systematically, saying, oh, well, this is a top secret project, this has done this and that and that. And then our mouths were dropped, and we all knew it was a lie, you know, in this dream. And I walked up to him, and I just shook his hand. I said, you know, I really have to commend you for keeping this information secret, all the work and effort and things that you do, you know. And it was kind of an interesting dream, because what actually happened was the media took care of the discrediting.
Yes.
And they fulfilled that. Nobody had to come up and discredit anybody. In fact, you know, when it went on, online, it was like 250,000 people logged on. It was the largest internet broadcast on the National Press Club. The first hour and a half was jammed and tracked back to the NSA. So it was a lot of effort in order to not get this out, but it's now out. But it's not on mainstream media. So, you know, people who watch, you know, CNN, the news you can trust, isn't getting you the full story in every mainstream media.
Dan, when it comes to the media, we are in a strange world. We have more outlets for information than ever before in the history of the world. And yet, if you look at the ratings, less than 30 million people are watching news at all. I think we have 300 million people here in this country. That's not a very good percentage, about 10%. I guess Americans just don't care.
That's exactly it. And, you know, they can continue these operations in secrecy quite effectively, but it's a disclosure when you put a 100-watt spot, you know, a big spotlight on is when everything starts to squirm, you know, because, you know, that's the last thing they want is a lot of exposure, like on this show. It's not something they're, you know, too pleased
Actually,
with.
Dan, one of the surprising things, we don't seem to have a shortage of people who want to come forward. I've heard of estimates of 500 people in the UFO area, in Black Project area, coming forward.
Well, minimum of 450 witnesses, you know, which include generals, admirals, astronauts. were making it up, you'd have a more unusual situation than what we're talking about.
I've been pretty hard on my media brothers. In fairness, we live in a strange world where things are not as they appear, or at least are not as they are presented. I mean, usually, for instance, if Washington says we have a fair housing law, it's probably unfair. You know what I mean.
Yeah, something's for your security. That means something dangerous is going on for you. You know, just like for the national security, these operatives are under the guise of national security. They're keeping the full message from getting out on the mainstream media, but it's not for the national security of the people of the United States of America.
No, it's for corporate security. Let's go back to 1954 and the things you were talking about. 1954, pretty impressive year when it comes to black ops and government secrets, at least in the UFO area and in the free energy area.
I don't know what exactly meetings happened, but it was obvious from everything I talk about. I talk about based on witness testimonies. This is based on General Lovkin, who was on Eisenhower's staff, who actually saw some of the wreckage from the Roswell crash and things. And he was told, if you get into this, you could be erased, and was threatened, if he talked.
A lot of these shows. Murder, mayhem, ruining people's careers. What's this all about? Is it just simply to protect people's income, the profit motive? Is that what is in play here?
Well, it probably relates better in people's mind if you think in terms of you have like a crime syndicate, mafia type of thing, where if you're going to mess with their business, they'll put you in cement galoshes, So when you have you're talking multi hundred trillion dollar oil industry with huge investments. I mean, you're talking a complete global change. If they released one of these, some of this technology that was discovered, according to our witnesses that we have. And so what they did was they usurped the control from our legal government and went into these rogue black operations controlled by these corporations. And they have their people in the military, in the intelligence communities, that help oversee this, make sure that they maintain the status quo. And that's how they do it. If you, Jerry, were a major CEO of a corporation that had all your money invested in a multi-trillion dollar oil industry, I mean, you had a big corporation and you knew that something was going to get released to the public that would just totally destroy your empire, and if you had enormous resources, you would do everything in your power in order to
I felt the corporate element here was the problem all along, and I've always felt that the corporations probably were in control, not really the military. We see that evidence all the time with privatization. Anyway, and now multilateral corporations, many of them are bigger than many governments, or most governments.
Well, it's not just having to do with money. It matters that, if they release this technology, think of places like in India, it would become equal and it would lose the geopolitical control.
Hold on, we have to take a break, Dan. Dan Wallace is our guest. He was disclosure witness number 6 at the National Press Club. He's been active in UFO disclosure issues, and we'll get back to it in a moment. Don't go away, folks. You know, when we pause for a commercial, it's always for somebody who pays the freight, pays the way. Well, I'm going to take time out to talk about somebody who can't pay their way. And that's the stray animals, dogs and cats and other animals, who need your help. And there is a way to help them. Support no-kill animal shelters.
It's a gift of life that keeps on giving. These animal shelters are located around the world and maybe in your neighborhood. Animals, they need love. They don't need to be sent someplace and then executed just because they don't have a home. Support the animal shelter that is a no-kill shelter near you. Give them a donation of $10, $25, $50 or more. The money will be well used. The animals will love you for it. So give a gift of love, a gift of life, to that stray dog or cat. Welcome back to the show. Dan Wallace is our guest, witness number 6 at that disclosure conference years ago. He's still out talking about UFO disclosure. We're talking about black projects right now and this alternative government idea where the elected officials maybe aren't really the people in charge, a shadow government, so to speak. Dan, you mentioned 1954. Is this a sea change? Surely back in 1954 there were some people in charge who thought maybe the good of humanity would be important. Surely not everyone was for keeping this away from the population.
You know, the controllers in the secret government, the top of the pyramid, so to speak, from what I understand, back in the beginning, it was about one-third were for releasing this technology out to the, you know, for the good of mankind. The other two-thirds were for maintaining control. And then recently, I understand, it's about 50-50. I understand there's even squarms going on inside the secret government, operations getting infiltrated.
Dan, I don't have trouble understanding or believing the New World Order story, the Illuminati, whatever you want to call them, but I do have trouble with the mindset of these executives going along with it. I mean, if I were in charge of ConocoPhillips, I guess it's the reason I'm not, I'd be trying to embrace this new technology and getting ahead of the competition. But maybe there's just not a new way to use it, this new technology on energy, and make some money.
Jerry, let's, you and I, let's try an experiment. Let's theoretically think, how could we correct the situation? If we know the elements of it, which is, you know, the biggest part of the game, because most people don't know all the elements, we have the facts based on over, 450 witnesses. So we've got that based on facts. We know that the government has been infiltrated. We know there's illegal operatives operating within the government. This is based on our legal government acknowledging this, from on the inside, not officially. And they control the media, so the average guy sitting on his couch back there watching CNN hasn't a clue what's going on. Oh, look at these people. Oh, they're wanting to have a congressional hearing about the reality of UFOs. Huh, a bunch of UFO nuts, you know. So they're not getting the message at all. And so they've got this, it's kind of a catch-22. As long as the people don't understand that our government has been infiltrated illegally, this situation perpetuates. And they can't come out and say, yeah, we lied to you, we took over control in 1954, we wanted to make profit on war and stuff. You know, there was a quote by Sarah McLennan, who was a famed White House correspondent, yep, in the movie UFO, The Greatest Story Ever Denied, which I'm in for about 2 seconds, Jose put out, a great movie. She had a quote from George Bush Sr. She said, Sarah, if they ever find out what we've done, they'd be chasing us down the road and lynching us.
One thing that stands out about the Bush family, both the father and the son, and that whole group of neocons, they're never bashful about telling you the truth. They just tell you straight out, it's so outlandish nobody accepts it, or something.
And you wonder why they smirk a lot.
Well, I have a pet theory. It's because they think they can do it and get away with it. And so far, they've been correct.
That's right. They go ahead forward anyway. Because they know they control the media, they control the military, they control, the whole thing. But
maybe we need to take something out of their playbook. Instead of trying to get the whole thing out there, let's take it one little baby step at a time.
Any one of the witness testimonies that happened at the National Press Club is explosive evidence. Let's take Carl Wolf, who worked at the NSA facility in Langley. He saw an alien base, you know, with dome, mushroom shape, towers, the whole pictures. He saw this, and, you know, I was in the hotel room with him at the Hilton, Washington, and he was, you know, nervous about this. He left his job, came over to say this in front of the media, and he said, you know, I was expecting it to come out in the news and the headlines, you know. 30 years later, and nobody has an idea what happened back in 1969, you know.
Are you talking about the landing on the moon?
Right.
I mean, we didn't go back, did we?
They didn't want us up there.
They should go home.
And we went home. Wanted to carve the whole thing up. You know, the NASA's a military operation. They were going up there for, you know, it was an arms race against the Soviets. And they were going to, you know, carve the moon up, you know, us and them and, you know, all that stuff. And they didn't want us. In fact, Professor Jacobs was at the Vandenberg facility when he was filming this rocket going up to the moon. We were going to blow up a nuclear warhead on the moon to show, impress the Russians how powerful we are. Well, what happened was the UFO came in. The rocket's going 17,000 miles per hour up through the clouds, and this UFO comes in, circles the warhead, and as it's circling, it's a plasma beam is shooting in from different angles. The warhead falls off. The UFO shoots off in the direction it came in. And the CIA comes in and cuts out that part of the film and says, you know, Professor Jacobs, I don't have to tell you about the severity of breaking national security, mentioning, you know, this type of thing. You know, so the ETs have shown that they're very concerned about us using nuclear weapons here on Earth, and they will not allow us to go out into space with our weapons.
Well, this administration and they didn't get the word. They seem pretty intent on taking weapons out into space.
Oh, they're
a little cynical comment by me. Hey, it's a good way to get another $1 trillion spent on the military defense establishment, right? I mean, battle those evildoers from outer space.
Well, you know, the crazy part about, you know, the reason why this keeps such good secrecy, Jerry, is because if people were to be told the entire truth, the entire story, it's far more bizarre than any science fiction movie, and that they have the technology, the faster than light craft, they call it alien reproduction vehicle. We have witnesses that have seen these things. And they even have, in genetics, they've done the same thing with these life forms, and they have a whole black operation team who's been working on this threat that Wernher von Braun, on his deathbed, warned us about, that the final card was going to be the alien card. And what they could do is they have the technology to easily hoax, and anybody, you know, scrutinizingly look at this and say, hey, we're being attacked from aliens from outer space. Mm-hmm. We need to build we need to globalize in one world government and build put trillions of dollars into this military thing, you know.
Okay, I understand the overall objective by the big boys, but how about the mid-level guys, the CIA officer or the military officer, a mid-level guy? Why does he go along with this whole program?
They have people that are in strategic positions that, and, you know, and they're not all as high-level.
Well, that's the way they do it, a mid-level guy. He can be in the know. The top guy, he may not know anything.
Director, right. I mean, the head of the CIA is not high enough to gain access.
Here again, Dan, we're back to the problem I see. I don't understand why these powerful people in government, put their foot down. Say, hey, I'm in charge here. You can't keep this from me. I mean, and if they can't make a difference, why don't they just resign? I guess it's the way we've gone forward with civilization here in the 21st century. It's what can I get out of it for me? If you get paid enough, you'll look the other way. I mean, it's even true in religion. I mean, look where religion is morphed. Now it's you get, you know, you're favored by God, and you make a lot of money.
Well, you know, the Vatican was in part on that 1954, and, you know, the meeting was substantiated, but just recently a witness came out that the Eisenhower meeting with the extraterrestrials, and they brought in the clergyman and the scientists and all that, that story.
The famous Eisenhower Edwards Air Force Base meeting with the ETs. He had a dental appointment that day, but nobody could find a record of it in Palm Springs, where he was on vacation. Supposed to have met with an ET ambassador. I wonder where that ET ambassador was from. I mean, we seem to know a lot about this meeting, but not that.
I have no idea. Well, it's good to have a healthy skepticism and question everything, you know. And I ask anybody who, you know, happens to be listening to the show is to go to disclosureproject.org. And, when we went and toured the cities across the U.S., nobody has the time to write a letter to their congressman, so I put an online fax, you know, so they can do it for free.
And well, I write my congressman regularly, and he regularly ignores me. Oh, he returns the mail. He answers something, but it's never exactly
what
I'm asking about.
30,000 faxes have gone out, and I had everybody send me the replies from the president, the vice president, the senators, representatives. I posted them on the website for everybody to write. And all of them, you know, well, we'll keep your views in mind at extraterrestrial hearings.
Or
official denials from NASA.
Mm-hmm.
NASA. That brings up another subject. Hold on, Dan. I got to take a break. When I come back, I want to talk to you about NASA.
Own the book that has unraveled and shaken the UFO and alien research establishment to its core. Already called An Incredible Book and An Incredible Story by George Norrie of Coast to Coast AM, UFO Highway offers the most explosive look at the most infamous underground base in the world, Dulce. Critically acclaimed author and researcher Anthony F. Sanchez breaks down the secret underground base and gives readers the innermost glimpse of the secretive military-industrial complex and the forbidden alien agenda. Learn how Sanchez explains the origins of humanity with startling proof, detailing how off-world intervention has been the cause for humanity's rapid and exponential growth in technology. As time draws down, are you prepared for the truth? Order this incredible, eye-opening book today at www.ufohighway.com. That's www.ufohighway.com.
Okay, now we were talking about NASA before the break, Dan Willis. The Challenger incident. If our government knows, and we have this alternative energy, and maybe an alternate space program, and we're doing all these things, then NASA and the people connected with NASA, they're all guilty of manslaughter. The Challenger incident, those people with the Challenger incident, they didn't need to die.
Well, and the charades, you know, I mean, the people who are in media are well-meaning people. The people who are in government.
Yeah, I can't go along with that anymore, Dan. I used to think that way, but I'm sorry to say, my brother and sisters in the media, they're traitorous. There are too many stories they haven't covered. Just because your boss or your assignment editor at your news organization tells you no, it doesn't mean you just drop the story. You can leak it to other people. You can get someone else to publish it. There's no excuse. They are not doing their job, period.
Oh, the truth is what will cut through it. You know, it's hard to, you have to keep making more lies to cover more lies, you know. And that's what we have. We have lies upon lies upon lies, layers of so many lies that goes back for so long. You know, like Donna Hare, who was one of the witnesses that worked at NASA, was told to airbrush. You know, these get airbrushed out before it gets to the public, you know, the UFO pictures. She said, I don't know how they do it. She had a secret level clearance that one person would know something
totally different than another person will go, well, that's how the whole thing operates.
Right.
You can have a compartment, and if you don't have a need to know, you're not in that.
You know, Dan, I want to find the doctor know-it-all, the guy who knows it all. Everybody seems to know a little bit here and a little bit there. Somebody must have the whole picture.
Well, I'm sure the structure works similar in the secret government pyramid up to the top controllers. But how do we break this loop, Jerry? How can we, even the people that are in these secret operations, a lot of them have realized that it's going down a path that is, and, you know, you talk about religion, and from what I understand from Dr. Greer, the eschatological belief systems of the people who are in controlling is that one, it, to continue in the destructive path that it's going, have this belief of the end of the world, Armageddon.
Armageddon. Don't take it lightly, Dan. What happened is when the Republican Party started using the religious right as a base to get elected, they would appease that wing of the party by simply appointing the sons and daughters to the military academies. Now, we've been going through this for three decades now, so... 40-50% of the military have been indoctrinated with this religious belief. They're fighting a religious war. They're serious about it.
Oh, they do. And they're in an intelligence community, too, heavily. It's hard for me to fathom exactly how they conceive all this, because I haven't been indoctrinated in any particular religion. I do believe in love, you know, and I have.
Yeah, but in my opinion, this movement has strayed far from agathe love. You know, the golden rule.
The Ten Commandments, you know,
right.
Do not kill, and all these things that they keep doing. And it's almost as though they've been given a free, well, Jesus is coming back, and it's okay to wait.
Yeah, a free pass. But let's get back to the UFO subject and disclosure. What would you suggest our listeners do, you know, to help the cause?
I would ask everybody who's listening to go to disclosureproject.org and send a fax to your representatives and put it in your own words, because a template letter doesn't get as effective a response as personalizing. And that's what I would ask everybody out there to do. Maybe if we get annoying enough with this truth that's coming out, that we have these hundreds of witnesses, to go to an open congressional hearing that can be covered honestly by the media.
I really think the media, and I'm part of the media, but I think the media's a bigger fault here than even the politicians.
Think about what has happened, the atrocities, the decisions that have been made by the secret government, the atrocities in the thousands of millions and millions of people in decades of suffering, of the technology that could have been shared by these off-planet cultures that are coming here, change our food, our medical, our energy, working in harmony with the Earth. You know, if you imagine it, as the extraterrestrial said to Colonel Corso as he drove across the White Sands desert out there to meet, and his ET being came out to him, and he said, he asked to shut down the radar systems, and he said, well, what's in it for me? And the ET said, you know, a new world, if you could take it. And that's basically what we've been denied, Jerry, for 50 years. It could have been a whole different world if it wasn't these corporate interests, secret government, whatever you want to call them, that have been manipulating our legal constitutional government that you and I have been sworn to protect.
Well, Dan, this hour is going pretty fast. We haven't really covered you personally. Dan Wallace, what are you doing these days? I mean, personally. I mean, besides talking with me.
That's about it. I'm wondering when I get an internet radio show. You know, I've given up trying to go on mainstream media on this because they just edit it out in the editing room. But the thing is, we have the facts. We have the witnesses. And that's indisputable. We have these people willing to come forth. You know, the 20 of us broke our national security oath in order to come forth, but they cannot use the rule of law against us because the operations are illegal that have been going on and have not been supervised by our legal government.
Well, Dan, actually, there is a little danger. I know of people who are missing. For instance, John Maynard, he testified with you guys. Later on, I think he called Dr. Greer and said that this problem he was having was not connected to the UFO Disclosure Project, and it may be true because John was with the DIA for a while. A lot of his friends are very worried about him. He just simply disappeared. He was at the LAX airport, and he called a friend from there and said that he thought some agents were following him and they were going to do him some harm. I'm not sure exactly what, you know, he had done. I know in the disclosure conference he mentioned the Atlantic Research Corporation. But I'm not even sure if they're still in business. He basically testified, I think, at the conference more about how corporate people with a need to know get together and make a lot of money off of some of these black projects, including UFOs. Yeah, by the way, if you know where John Maynard is, contact us. Or John, if you're listening, just let us know if you're okay or not. Anyway, Dan Wallace, thanks a lot for a great hour. Hope we can do it again sometime.
I'd love to.
Dan Wallace has been our guest, and we've been talking about black ops, UFO disclosure, alternative energy. Evidently, it's all intertwined. This program was produced and edited by Jane Swartley. Listening to the Jerry Pippin UFO Show, brought to you in part by Strange Lights Publishing. Publishers of UFO Highway. UFO Highway is the most talked about book in decades. It concerns all of the UFO hotspots, including Area 51 and Dulce. To get more information, go to UFOHighway.com. Stephen Bassett has a new disclosure petition out on the WhiteHouse.gov website, and he has about 700 almost signatures now. Early this morning was at 500, and he needs about 25,000. So he has a way to go, but he has almost an entire month. But I would urge you, if you're interested in getting the latest in UFO disclosure, go over to the WhiteHouse.gov website. The best way to do that is simply go to our website, UFOShowsToGo.com or JerryPippin.com, and you'll see the write-up on the homepage about the petition and a picture of Steve Bassett. Simply click on that link, and you'll be at the WhiteHouse.gov website. Register. It's all about Roswell, this petition. And it's about time, don't you think? It's been a little over 65 years. How long should we be keeping a secret? After all, we're grown, we're adults, we can handle it. Come on, White House. Let's have a little revelation or two. You know, the Border Zone Conference, which is coming up in October 19th and 20th, we actually do a broadcast, a special, the night before on October 18th, so you might want to keep that in mind as we get a little closer to that date. But one of the speakers is Stanton Friedman. And we did an interview with Stanton Friedman some time back in which really it's the consummate interview. It tells all about Stanton Friedman. We had some time. We sat down and we really talked about the issues, about how he found out about Roswell, how he got involved in the UFO business to begin with. It's a very interesting interview. So let's go ahead and play that now. We're at Angel Fire in New Mexico, and Stanton T. Friedman's with us. And everybody knows you, Stan. You've been around for a long time, and now...
That's a penalty for being old.
Yeah. Well,
and bold, and loud.
I can understand that, being the same.
I don't know which of us is older, to tell you the truth.
You just slightly.
Oh, okay.
Just slightly.
First of all, before we do anything, tell me a little bit about this Magic Man movie thing that the Bruce Zabel was talking to me about.
Bryce Zabel, yes.
Yeah.
I've known Bryce for about 15 years, and actually he wrote a favorable review on the back cover of the book Top Secret Magic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about the Majestic 12 documents.
Right.
And especially in the second edition, I make a point of trying to deal with all the objections to these documents that have been put forth by the noisy negativists of one kind or another. And I think I have satisfactorily provided a rebuttal for all of these objections. And yet there are still people in ufology who say, well, everybody knows those documents are fraudulent. And it's aggravating because they don't give you facts and data. I've been at this a long time. I've been to 20 archives. Anyway, Bryce has been well aware. You know, he did the series Dark Skies,
mm-hmm.
which really is a similar sort of thing to the Majestic 12 business. So he also knows Don Schmidt and how Don has had his ups and downs in Roswell investigation, and that Don's and my paths have crossed from time to time. Don didn't really start into Roswell until he asked me a question at a lecture I gave in Illinois at a college. He said, is there really anything more to be done with Roswell? This is 20 years ago. And I said, Don, there's plenty to do, but I can't afford to do it. I've been spending tons of money on trying to locate people and all the rest. I live back very far east. there's a lot to be done. There are more witnesses to be found, more documents to be found. So he pursued his path of investigating, which he's done a lot of. He's changed partners, so have I, in a sense. And Bryce saw the possibilities here of something, put it succinctly, would be sort of like All the President's Men and JFK combined.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, there's dramatic impact here. There's conflict. There's how things have progressed, positive and negative. We both had problems with some witnesses who turned out to be fraudulent. And how do you handle this? We think, considering that we've been at this, you know, it's more than 20 years. I've been investigating Roswell for 32 years. That it might bring the story home to the public in a way that only movies can. You know, I've got my name on 5 books now, and Don has written several books, but in today's world, a movie can have far more impact than a book. I mean, I hate to admit that. So I'm hoping that they're working on a screenplay now. And, the funny question is, so who's going to play you, Stan? And I don't know who's going to play me in the movie. In other words, this will be a feature film.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a documentary.
Right.
It's a movie that has a story to tell.
You mentioned All the President's Men as something similar to that, that movie.
Yeah, the efforts that those guys went through, Woodward and Bernstein. And,
right.
You know, I've been saying for years, people say, what would it take to break this story loose? I've said it would take a Woodward and Bernstein with some backing from somebody like the Washington Post. It wasn't just those two guys after all. There was a lot of money spent, you know, following the money, doing all those other things that need to be done. And I think you could do it in 6 months if you really made the effort. So I'm excited at the prospect, partly because I respect Bryce and Don Most, they're both very interested in the subject. People remember Don Most from Happy Days, but he's also been involved in other motion pictures
yes,
and production
has.
And so forth. So, and Bryce is a wheel in the industry in Hollywood, if you will, president of one of the important groups and stuff.
Yeah, despite me mispronouncing his first name, I do know him and met him recently. And he's quite a go-getter.
He is a go-getter. And so I'm excited about I've had other dealings with Hollywood. Every so often somebody, oh, we want to make a show, you want to be involved. Yeah, I'm interested. And they never seem to work out. And even my own documentary, UFOs Are Real, which was done way back in, 79. It's hard to imagine. My dealings with Hollywood were not the kind that I really appreciated. Because I'm concerned with facts, with data, with truth. That's what a scientist is all about. And these guys, that didn't seem to be their major concern.
Yeah.
But Bryce,
That's an understatement.
Yeah, I'm being kind. Be kind to dumb Hollywoodians. I just made up a new word. So I'm really hopeful that this will turn into something good and big. And, you know, I must admit, in making UFOs are real, and I travel all over the country, I found movie making one of the most frustrating things I've ever done. Because you spend hours, days to get, you know, 3 minutes worth of film.
Mm-hmm.
And you slog along day after day, and I'm too impatient for that. I want to, if I'm going to go to an archive, I want to dig into things, you know, get hours worth of work, not 2 minutes worth of work.
Yeah, this project, even though it's now well underway, will probably be 18 months or so before it's finished.
Oh, at least, yeah. And I just hope I'm around when it's finished, that's all. And my great-grandson can see his great-grandpa portrayed in the film.
Now, you mentioned a couple of things that I wanted to follow up here a little bit about. Don Smith, you're the one that got him interested, huh?
Well, to dig into Roswell, yes.
Yes.
The fund for UFO research had been sort of off to the side. Not the fund, I'm sorry, the QFOS. Dr. Hynek's organization, and Don worked closely with Dr. Hynek. And they were very, conservative about crash saucers, Center for UFO Studies we're talking about. And, you know, I knew Alan. He was the same age as my father. He didn't like being reminded of that. But I could never get him to dig into this question of interstellar travel. For some reason, and it's part of what I'm going to say here, astronomers are stuck at the Pony Express stage of development of human transport. You know, if you were to say, what's a fast means for spreading information? If you told me Pony Express, I'd say, I'll take the Internet, you know, instantaneous kind of thing. These guys haven't gotten beyond the notion of chemical rockets, for God's sakes. And Alan had the same problem. So Don asked me only because he knew that I had been digging into it for a long time and would have some idea of what the scope of the work. I won't say I inspired him. That's probably the wrong way to put it. But I gave him a straight answer, and I said I'd help if I could, and I have. And we've shared views about the witnesses and so forth. We also have spent a lot of time in Roswell. He more than I would say.
You mentioned a little earlier that both of you have been led down the primrose path occasionally. I have too. We all have.
Really?
Yeah. Why do you think these guys do this sort of thing?
You know, I don't know. Frank Kaufman was his bête noir, and the funny thing is, right from the beginning with Frank, I was suspicious because he said and did things that didn't make any sense to me. And I was pleased, at least before he died, that when I asked him... Now, Frank, remember, had this great story. He was a member of a group of nine at Roswell, and they could do anything. They knew everybody. They had everything. He knew all about Roswell. And he was over at White Sands when they spotted on radar this object that exploded on the screen, and he called back, and somebody had seen something come down. He rushed back over the mountains to Roswell, woke up Colonel Blanchard and Jesse Marcel, and they drove out across the rough country and spotted this craft on the ground. And, you know, by the end of the day, the end of that morning, they had brought out a flatbed truck from Roswell and put this thing on it and brought it back to the base, and, you know, just like that. And to me, that made absolutely no sense whatsoever. In the first place, the people who owned the land said the only way you could get out in that area was with a horse. There were no roads and stuff. And secondly, Colonel Blanchard was head of the only atomic bombing group in the world. He would never have left the base without some better idea of what was going on out there. Mm-hmm. I mean, if it was one of his B-29s, which just happened to have a nuclear weapon on board, yeah, he'd have gone out all right. But other than something like that, he never would have. Jesse Marcel, I was the first to talk to Jesse way back in 1978.
Yeah, I wanted to get into that, Nobody. Go ahead.
Well, I just said he would never reacted the way he did days later if he had already been out there, already seen bodies and wreckage and all this kind of stuff. And it's standard practice when an airplane goes down that you want to see things in situ, that is, as they are, so that you can discover, you know, was in the case of an airplane, was the landing gear cracked, were the flaps up or down? And you can't just go gathering stuff up and shove it on a truck and get it out of there. There was no danger of tourists coming along. This was out in the middle of nowhere. You know, that was not a problem. So I was pleased when Frank finally, just before he died, I was at his home with several other people and asked him, did he take Blanchard out? No. Did he take Jesse Marcel out? No. So I was sort of vindicated, but I couldn't convince Don's former associate, Kevin Randall. To him, Frank Kaufman was the answer to all the problems. He's got a whole book in which Frank's name comes up all the time, mm-hmm. as knowing everything. And to me, I understood Frank. He was from New York, which helped explain a few things. Yeah. I'm from New Jersey. So that was part of the problem. Also, there was a whole business with Bill Moore and me and Don and Kevin Randall, conflict and human interactions, if you will. And people wanted to blame me for what Bill was doing, and Kevin turned on Don. Had apparently said that he had some degrees he didn't have, and Don defended him. I mean, Kevin defended Don without doing any checking. What I did was the next day after I heard that, I called the post office where supposedly Don worked, and he answered the phone. He wasn't just walking by.
Mm-hmm.
So he had never told me he had those degrees, so I didn't feel, you know, that he had lied to me. Anyway, there is conflict, and there are joys, too. Frankly, when I heard about the MJ-12 documents, Bill Moore called me up and read me the list of the names of people, and he saved the best one for last, Donald Menzel, Harvard debunker of UFOs. Boy, that's all we need was somebody, you know, was that. And I didn't like Menzel. I'd had one run-in with him. At Harvard, I was speaking to a retired an engineering alumni group, and I called him earlier in the day because I didn't know whether this was a campus-wide thing or just for this group. I often give presentations to members of a certain group, American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, that sort of thing. So I called, and Dr. Menzel, yes, my name is Stanton Friedman, and, oh, I know all about you, he says. I said, oh, you saw my congressional testimony next to yours? No, I've seen letters and memos. You can't be a scientist and believe in flying saucers. And I laughed. What else am I going to do?
Yeah.
He got mad, started ranting. And I said, look, Dr. Menzel, I didn't call to argue with you. I called out of courtesy. I'm going to be speaking on your campus and didn't know whether you knew about it. So I wanted to invite you personally to be there. Well, of course I won't go. And I told that story that night at the lecture, incidentally, and Alan Hynek told me he never could have told the story. Anyway, so here his name is on this list. And I'm thinking, boy, that's all we need. Well, I had a couple of leads that maybe moved me in the right direction. And some of the Vannevar Bush papers. Vannevar Bush was the top dog scientist in the country, head of the Office of Scientific Research and Development, which covered the atom bomb and a proximity fuse and 80 other devices for winning a war. And there was a letter in his papers from Menzel's attorney thanking Bush for his testimony on Donald's behalf at a loyalty hearing. Loyalty hearing? That raised a lot of questions. There's a big legal firm in Boston. This was not a little podunk outfit that wrote the letter. And Bush didn't have to defend anybody. He was above all that sort of stuff. And then I got a grant from the Fund for UFO Research that would cover the cost of going to Harvard. I had to get permission from three different people to look at his papers. I had already seen his UFO correspondence at the American Philosophical Society Library in Philadelphia. Nothing exciting there, except the communication between him and Ed Condon. They obviously knew each other and stuff. So I'm going there with an open mind and not really having any idea of finding anything very useful. And at the Harvard archives, after getting permission from three different people to look at this stuff, I don't see anything. So just because I'm a curious guy, there was a file labeled John F. Kennedy. That seems strange. And so I looked at that file and was totally shocked because there's correspondence between him and Kennedy. Now, the connection was straightforward. Kennedy was on the board of overseers at Harvard, and his area of interest, and every member picked an area and got to know it better, was astronomy. And so Menzel was his guide, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And it turns out, and I got this from his wife, too, that Menzel, like JFK, greatly respected him, was impressed. He even wrote his own reports, and there were other guys who had asked Menzel to write the report for them, you know. But here we find a statement, Menzel to Kennedy, saying, there is an area where I may be able to be of considerable utility. That's with regard to the National Security Agency. I have had a longer continuous association with this organization, more than 30 years at that time, of anybody in the country. When we are properly cleared to each other, I can tell you more. You know, those are rather exciting words. And then when I look at his unpublished autobiography, there's Menzel saying he was very active in cryptography. He was did classified work for the FBI, for the CIA, for 30 different companies. He led a double life. Nobody on the outside knew that.
Mm-hmm.
As far as they knew, he was a debunker. And the thing that really caught me is you don't need a high-level security clearance to teach astronomy at Harvard. You know, all the other 11 out of 12, I knew from the jobs they'd held that they had to have high-level security mm-hmm. clearances. Three were directors of Central Intelligence, you know, stuff like that. So these findings on Menzel, and then talking to his wife, talking to people who knew him at the office, I found one guy who was very close to him who knew that he did a lot of work for the government. That's all, you know. He didn't know anything about MJ-12 or anything like that. And then, so I kept digging, and as a matter of fact, somebody, a MUFON person in Minneapolis, mentioned that they had had a big 50th anniversary of the organization thing, and he got to talking to somebody there who mentioned that he knew Menzel, and that Menzel had left in a hurry one time under sort of strange circumstances. So I talked to the guy. And yes, he was younger at the time than Menzel was. And Menzel suddenly had to leave. He did consulting work. As a matter of fact, I found papers in Menzel's file. He was getting like $18,000 a year as a consultant. This is back in the 40s.
And that good was money.
Very good money. I'll tell you. And so I asked this guy, and he said, yeah, he remembered Menzel, and he was a younger man than the one I was talking to. And I said, there was something about, at one point he left in a hurry. He said, yeah, one summer, he worked there summers usually, mm-hmm. you know, as many professors do. And he suddenly had to leave. And he had the impression, the guy I was talking to, that it was very classified and that Menzel did, and it was important. And Menzel wouldn't tell him what it was, just that he had to be gone. And so I asked very carefully, biting my tongue the whole time, what year was that? And there was a pause, and said, well, let me see now. Yeah, 1947, I think. I didn't say, was it 47?
Yeah, right.
Which would just provide me with an echo, which mm-hmm. would mean nothing. So anyway, to make a long story short, the joy of finding out that Menzel belonged to that team, much as I didn't like him, I developed an appreciation for him. And I had so much reaction. How can a guy lead a double life? I said, every spy leads a double life. There were three guys in England, Burgess, McLean, and whoever the third guy was, he was the most famous of them, who were spies for Russia working for MI5. Now, that's leading a double life because you've really got to be careful.
They're certainly a double agent, right.
You know, and so it happens all the time. Anyway, that was a high point. There were low points. You track down people. I found a guy, an archaeologist, who mentioned that one of the stories that I was very interested in was the crash over in the plains of San Augustine.
Mm-hmm.
And found a guy named, whose name was Drake, actually. Not Frank Drake. And he mentioned that there was this guy that he knew who had come to a conference in Mexico and had come, had worked at Los Alamos and had stopped by the Plains of San Agustin. He knew something from working at Los Alamos that there had been a crash at the Plains of San Agustin. And I got his name, and he lived in Ottawa, and it was an unusual enough name, so I was able to track it down, a number, called, talked to his wife, and, yeah, he's off on a dig in British Columbia, and he'll be back in a month. Call back then. Okay, great. I established this guy was a professional. He was a PhD, legitimate researcher and all that. And I called back a month later, and he had just died of a heart attack.
Wow.
And, you know, what do you ask a widow? It just happened. And so a year later, I called. She remembered me because her sister had just died. So mm-hmm. That's twice I hit. And so that was great disappointment, you know. Why didn't I call 5 days sooner or stuff like that? One of the frustrations. I was able to establish that he had been at Los Alamos. And Los Alamos has an enormous amount of information. When I visited there, I had professional dealings as a nuclear physicist on the nuclear rocket program. They were working on nuclear rockets. We at Westinghouse were. And so I was able to look in their library, and they had a lot of stuff on UFOs. Obviously, there was great interest there. As a matter of fact, the first privately published version of Project Blue Book, Special Report 14, came from a scientist who had worked at Los Alamos. And that really got me rolling on UFOs. So, to get back to Magic Man, as I've talked to Bryce and Don Schmidt has talked to them, we've come up with a lot of these little events that happened, these significant events that, in retrospect, have dramatic impact. And so I'm optimistic that with his skills and imagination and knowledge of the field, a lot of people who want to do a UFO movie because they think people would be interested, but don't know a damn thing.
Right.
And so that's what's different here, is that we have people who...
So you're really hopeful that this movie, if it gets made, and probably will, and you know the people involved, so it'll probably turn out pretty well, it may open some doors, get some people interested.
Yeah, because I found that people never want to be leading the pack and coming out from behind the veil of secrecy. I worked under security for 14 years. I understand that. And, you know, I get people are so ignorant about security. I've had one guy say, well, all those members of MJ-12 would have told their spouses. No, you don't tell your wife. I never told my wife anything classified.
Mm-hmm.
You can't control what your wife says to anybody.
Right.
If the enemy thinks he can get information from spouses, the heck with you. You know, pillow talk, that's the way to find out what's going on. I've had people say the SETI people really aggravate me. Silly effort to investigate. That's
you're talking SETI. About that here, I think.
Yeah, that's one of the major points that I will make. Is here we got these guys saying the government can't keep secrets, and Seth Shostak, now I've met Seth, he's heard me talk, I've heard him talk, big shot in the SETI field. I mean, this is a government that, look how they fouled up at Katrina and FEMA and stuff. It's the same government that runs the post office, for God's sakes. Now, why didn't he say something like the NRO, the NSA, the CIA, the DIA, all the intelligence agencies? How about Lockheed developing the stealth aircraft? 10 years, $10 billion in complete secrecy. I mean, I get a little irked at people who haven't done their homework. And part of my theme today, or tomorrow, actually, will be that they don't seem to realize that aside from research being conducted in academia, the publisher perish crowd, as I call them, there's an enormous amount of very good, advanced, applied research and development that goes on outside of academia. The national laboratories, Los Alamos, Sandia, Lawrence Livermore, three nuclear weapons labs, amongst them employ 20,000 people. thousands of professionals. Each have an annual budget over $1 billion. This isn't six professors and 12 grad students, for goodness sakes. There are things like the General Electric Research Labs, the Bell Labs, the Lewis Research Labs. There's Hanford Works. There's Oak Ridge National Laboratory. There's a whole big community of people who much of their work is classified, but whose goal is to get it, accomplish a particular objective on a particular program, whether it's building a nuclear airplane, testing a nuclear rocket engine. And it's the nuclear part that I've realized that these ancient academics and fossilized physicists have no idea that there's something beyond chemical rockets. You can't get here from there. The head of the Hayden Planetarium stupidly said, and I'd say that to his face, that, look, our fastest vehicle, the Voyager spacecraft, would take 70,000 years to get to the next star. What a stupid thing to say. It doesn't have a propulsion system on it. It's been coasting, floating, if you will, coasting. Chemical rockets are not the be-all and end-all chemical reactions. That's like saying fossil fuel is it, for goodness sakes. And I will point out that many people don't seem to be aware. World War II, a big bomb, was a 10-ton blockbuster. B-29s would carry those, mm-hmm. and they make quite a mess below, you know. But that was World War II. Okay, come Hiroshima, suddenly the ante is up. That's the equivalent of 15,000 tons of TNT. That's a pretty good jump.
Yes, it is.
In a short period of time. Well, let's go beyond that. We figured out, I mean, look at the rapid pace. We didn't even discover there were neutrons until 1932. They've been here all the time, you understand, long before we knew them, about them. We figured out that probably the process that produces the energy of the stars is nuclear fusion. That was in 1938, theoretical. We put it to use in 1952. We exploded our first H-bomb. Now, Hiroshima was 15,000 tons of TNT equivalent energy release. Mike, out in the Pacific, 10 million tons of TNT equivalent.
Yeah, it's just
one bomb.
Mind-boggling.
And the Russians exploded one that was 57 million tons. And the kicker about this is, I worked on fusion propulsion systems. We did a study of it at Aerojet General Nucleonics back in the early 60s. And here's why. In the first place, every advanced civilization is going to know about fusion because that's what makes its star work. That's the big source of energy on the block, so to speak.
Yep.
In the second place, if we use the right stuff in the right way, and it just happens to be isotopes of hydrogen and helium, which is very convenient, these are the two most abundant substances in the universe. You may not find uranium everywhere, but you're going to find hydrogen and helium everywhere. Okay, if you use the right stuff in the right way and kick particles out the back end that have 10 million times as much energy per particle. 10 million
per
times
particle?
Per particle, as you can get in a dumb old chemical rocket. 10 million times. So why would anybody in his right mind, especially in the astronomical community, be stuck at the level of chemical reactions? Do they still think the sun is a massive burning gas? Lord Kelvin thought that around the turn of the 20th century, 1902 or something like that. Not more than 30,000 years or 30 million years, doesn't matter. He thought it was chemical process. So what I'm getting at is, of course, this stuff was all done outside of academia. And these guys can't seem to understand that there's a new ballgame out there. You know, it's not the Pony Express. It's the Internet that we're looking at now for information transfer. Friedman's Law, I named stuff after myself, you know. Technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. The future is not an extrapolation of the past. And
it's
also
Friedman's Law. Okay.
Yeah. When we recognize how young we are on a cosmic scale, I mean, go back to the year 1900. We hadn't flown an airplane. We hadn't fired a rocket. Electronics were non-existent. DNA, fission, fusion, all this stuff didn't exist as far as we were concerned. Now, there are stars in our local neighborhood that are at least a billion years older than the sun. I mean, I got kind of a shock. I suppose I shouldn't have. I was speaking to a couple of college classes in Detroit, the University of Detroit, and I went through how much things have changed within my lifetime and pointed out that when I started working in industry, I was using a slide rule. I looked around the class, didn't see any reaction at all. So finally, I asked, I said, anybody here know what a slide rule is? Not one student in the class. That was less than 50 years earlier. So we've come a long way, and I'm sure these SETI cultists, as I call them, aren't using slide rules. They're using terabyte computers, for God's sakes. I wonder how much, if they appreciate how remarkable an inexpensive computer that's sitting on my desk, less than $1,000, what that would have been like 50 years ago. I mean, incredible. I think of some of the brilliant professors I had at Chicago, Singh Chandrasekhar, he did all kinds of calculations about radiation transfer in stars, basically with desk calculators. And if he had only had a computer, much more he might have accomplished, you know, in just this short time frame. So my message to people is, A, that there's overwhelming evidence that some UFOs are alien spacecraft. B, that the reasons that it's not being taken seriously, besides the self-interest. I mean, let's face it, if aliens are visiting, who needs a radio telescope? Learn sign language, you know, if you want to find out about life out there. They're not looking for intelligence. They're looking for radio signals. And I love the assumption, and we've been treated to discussions about this past 9 months. The assumption is that aliens are sending signals to us using technology appropriate for our equipment and for our times. Now, why would anybody make such a stupid assumption?
Yeah, in our own lifetime, it's hard to find anybody who knows Morse code anymore.
Yeah, that doesn't happen every day, right. And the thing is that Stephen Hawking, a great physicist, says they're not coming here because if they had, they'd have sent us a signal first. What are you going to send? Hey, we're bringing 30 guys for dinner, and we don't like pork. They're Jewish out there, of course. But, I mean, it's one of those utterly asinine notions that they would use technology appropriate to us when we've had such a short period of time. And look how, I mean, are they sending AM or FM? You know, digital or analog? And what will the question be 50 years from now?
You know, yeah, that's an interesting analogy, the AM or FM. I know younger people who just don't know how to find the AM band.
What's an AM band?
That's the morning show, isn't it?
AM, morning?
And now FM's suffering the same thing as they go digital. So.
Yeah, and it's going to all be different in not very long.
Very shortly.
Yeah, and what people forget, there is a transition time. I got boxes of vinyl records at home.
Same here. Can't find a player.
I did find one. Still haven't used them. But, what we're both agreeing on is that technology has been changing very rapidly in a few years. But if you got tens of hundreds, thousands, millions of years, and, you know, this is as bad as the attitude about Copernicus. Now, you got to admire the guy's guts. He had this crazy idea, which he wouldn't let be published. The book came out in the year he died, 1543, in which he had the gall to suggest, how stupid, that the Earth isn't the center of the universe. The belief was that the Earth's the center and the sun and the other planets revolve around the Earth. You know, very straightforward. Copernicus said, no, the sun is the center of the universe. The book was banned for 300 years, for God's sakes, because everybody knew that was nonsense. That was stupid. Well, okay. These guys don't seem to understand that we are now no longer next to the center of the universe. The sun isn't the center of the universe either. And that we're not the big shots these guys would like to think we are. We're latecomers. It's the time factor. I mean, you know, you realize we didn't discover that there were such things as neutrons until 1932. you'd think they didn't exist before we discovered them. You know, we've been made of neutrons all this time. There are many other things we didn't know until very, very recently. And most of them, that was discovered at a university, but most of the technological stuff was done outside the university environment. So we have, there ought to be a PhD thesis here. You know, the sociological complications of aliens visiting Earth. And the Brookings Institute report, I hadn't fully appreciated this, said one of the things that would happen if there was contact with extraterrestrials, one of the groups most affected would be scientists. Because their power, their omnipotence, their being the big shots would suddenly be down the tubes.
Their answers are wrong.
Yeah, yeah. And I begin to appreciate that now. I look at the desperation with which these guys are talking about radio signals.
Well, we see this, Stanton, not only in our field, but almost everything. The human brain likes to think it's a great pioneer, and it's very egocentric, but for some reason they don't want to accept these new ideas. And I think part of it is that the establishment, they're making money, they're doing fine, they got a good reputation.
Status, yes. Well, there was a comment made by a German scientist, Max Planck. New ideas come to be accepted, not because their opponents come to believe in them, but because their opponents die and a new generation grows up that's accustomed to them. And that's what seems to happen, actually. They fight to their dying breath to defend the old way of looking at things.
We're talking with Stanton T. Friedman, and we are at Angel Fire, a great place in northern New Mexico. If you've never been here, you need to check it out. I'm Jerry Pippin, and Stanton, I had two things to ask you, and
sure.
We started, and I wanted to talk about the contemporary investigations of Stanton T. Friedman, but I want to go back now to the early years. Let's talk about that meeting with Jesse Marcel. You were at a television station, as I recall. And,
well,
yeah. Were you interested in this subject? Were you there doing a UFO show, or what were you doing?
Yeah, I got interested in flying saucers in 1958, read Ed Ruppelt's book.
Uh-huh.
Report on Unidentified Flying Objects. He was head of Project Blue Book. And then the great discovery that set me off in a new direction was at the University of California, Berkeley Library. I mean, I'd read that one book, moved to California, had a good librarian, read 14 other books, some of which were utter trash, including one by Menzel, as a matter of fact. And there I am at the University of California, Berkeley. I was taking a course there, and so I'd stop off at the library. And I discovered the report on unidentified flying objects. That was Ruppelt's book. That was there, too. But the one I found was Project Blue Book Special Report 14. And here was data on 3,201 sightings. It was done for the Air Force. I didn't know who did it at that time. I found out later. They had quality evaluations, classification of all these sightings, statistical cross-comparison, 240 charts, tables, graphs, and maps. I was in data heaven. I like data. But the guy who put this together is Dr. Leon Davidson that I'd mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
He had included a copy of the press release that went out in October 1955. The government didn't release the report. They released the press release. The press release didn't say who did the work. They didn't say where the work was done, Battelle Memorial Institute, as I found out. They didn't give the title even. Surely some reporter, if they'd said 14, would have said, what happened to 1 through 13? We haven't heard anything about them. An honest answer, which wouldn't have been given, would have been that they were all classified. But the real kicker was a statement by the Secretary of the Air Force in this very widely distributed press release. On the basis of this report, we believe that no objects such as those properly described as flying saucers have overflown the United States. Even the unknown 3% could have been identified as conventional phenomena or illusions if more complete observational data had been available. That seems very straightforward. There's really nothing to this, just not enough data. But I had the report in front of me and was looking at the tables and the charts, and where'd that 3% come from? If you tabulate those 3,201 sightings, and they had categories like balloons and astronomical, you know, conventional stuff, psychological aberrations, crackpot cases. That was 1.5%, incidentally. Here were the unknowns. Were they 3%? No, they were 21.5%. That's not a misprint. You know, that's not a rounding off error. In addition, there was another category called insufficient information. If there wasn't enough data available about a sighting, it could not be listed as an unknown. And it's only the unknowns that we're interested in. There were 9.3% unknown, insufficient information. So that one shook me up. Look, I was working under security. I've been lecturing for, at that time, I hadn't given any lectures in 1960. But when you work under security, sometimes you are rather careful in what you say to avoid releasing classified information. There are certain rules, and you try not to lie, but you don't want to give out classified data either. But flat-out lying was something new to me, especially from the Secretary of the Air Force. So I was determined to get to the bottom of this. I joined APRO and NICAP. We talked about it, brown bagging lunches at the technical places that I worked. And I gave my first lecture. It's hard to imagine looking back at my life, you know, what a strange way to start my public UFO career. Frank Edwards had published a book, Flying Saucer Serious Business, in the mid-60s. I was living in Indianapolis. I spent 3 years at each of several places as they canceled government-sponsored research and development programs. You know, see the country, work on radiation shielding for nuclear systems. You'll get a chance to change jobs every so often. Anyway, I'd gotten to know Frank in Indianapolis, and he sent me a copy of his new book. And I called him, and I said, Frank, you know everybody. He was a newsman, radio program, and he was active in NICAP and so on the board. I said, Frank, you know everybody. Here I am in Pittsburgh, work for Westinghouse. Give me some names. I'd like to speak out publicly. So he gave me a bunch of names. One of them was a producer of a talk show at KDKA Pittsburgh, one of the old-time radio stations,
right.
One of the biggest...
famous station.
Clear Channel station. And so I called them. The guy was a producer of a show called, would you believe, Contact. I love the title in retrospect. And I gave him the pitch, you know, I'm a Westinghouse nuclear physicist. Normally that would mean something, but his was kind of, don't call us, we'll call you. Less than a month later, he called me at 6:30. Could I be on the show at 7 o'clock? I live near the station. It turns out somebody had canceled at the last minute, and I've often wondered, how many people did they call who couldn't make it before they finally got down to the bottom of the list, you know, call Friedman. So I did the show. And I wasn't as good then as I am now at handling nasty, noisy negativists. The show host didn't know what he was talking about, but I was too polite, frankly. But a woman at work, a technical assistant, was involved with a book review club, and the book they were reviewing was Frank's book. She asked me to give a talk to her club in her living room. That was my first lecture. I was on that show many times after that, did a whole bunch more lectures. Mostly the chicken and pea circuit, as I like to call it. You know, everybody needs a free program, and we'll give you dinner. sometimes you get gas, you know. And then another serendipitous event. I lived downtown Pittsburgh. Westinghouse, where I worked, was out of town. And one of 2 days, we'd take turns, people who had to leave their car in a garage, you know, and they'd drive the other, pick them up and drop them off later. Going into work with Joanne, PhD, supervisor at Westinghouse Astronuclear Lab. And I'm telling her, you know, I'd really like to speak at Carnegie Mellon University. She says, why don't you talk to the dean? I said, well, I talked to Dr. So-and-so, and he wasn't interested. She said, Stan, the dean's my husband. He's heard you on the radio. Give him a call. Okay. So I did, and he booked me. We set up a date, but it was a daytime talk, and I knew I'd have to take some time off work. So he finally asked, how much do you want? I thought, well, how about $100, thinking he'd knock me down to 50. This is back in the 60s, you understand. Sold, and then because I knew his wife, he told me what he was paying the other speakers in this series, $1,500, $1,600, $1,800. Well, the talk went very well. He sent a letter to the agency. They booked me at a key talk for me, Engineering Society of Detroit. This is not a bunch of little old ladies in tennis shoes, hard-nosed engineers. Turns out they were sold out 3 weeks in advance for 1,008 people for dinner and a talk. And there wasn't one negative attack of any kind.
Now, what year was this?
This would have been, 68, maybe.
Okay.
And so, funny thing, I asked management. I said, look, I'd like to do more lectures, but I've got a security clearance, I've got a wife, I've got a house, I've got a kid, mortgage. I don't want to lose any of these things. I need some guidance. What can I do and what can I do? I don't want somebody to come to me, well, we don't like what you've been doing, so you're fired kind of thing. You know,
yeah.
You're casting a bad light on the company or something like that. So my boss's boss's boss, somebody comes back with the guidance. Three things, Stan. You can say what you please on your time. You can identify yourself as a Westinghouse nuclear physicist. But we would like you to start each lecture with a disclaimer. The views you're about to hear are mine and mine alone and not those of my employer. What more could you ask for? Well, something more. I get a call from an associate at Los Alamos, also working on nuclear rockets. Hey, Stan, how about speaking to the local chapter of the American Nuclear Society? I said, I'd love to. Well, I mean on an expense account, Stan. I said, I don't make those decisions. I'm in Pittsburgh. He's in New Mexico, you know. Mm-hmm. So I talked to management, and they said yes. I mean, Westinghouse is a corporate member of the American Nuclear Society. I'm a member of the American Nuclear Society. But still, they didn't have to say yes. So I went out there with everybody knowing I was there to give a lecture, Flying Saucers Are Real, to the Los Alamos section of the American Nuclear Society. We had 500 people there. For them, a very big crowd. No negative reactions at all. So when it came time to get off the business of working 3 years, 3 years, 3 years, you know, they weren't spending money anymore and stuff that I was interested in. I finally went full-time in 1970. Never really turned back. I've done some technical work along the way. But but what I found, several things. I'm not a masochist. I found that the response was extremely good. And I come on very, very strong. I'm not an apologist, ufologist. I found that not only are people interested, but they're attentive, they're curious, but they're fearful of ridicule. As strong as I come on, I've only had 11 hecklers in over 700 lectures, and two of them were drunk. So, you know, you're going to get that many if you talk
like
about sports, religion, politics,
right,
whatever.
I'd like to have that record. I used to do stand-up comedy. I would like
Oh, boy. Somebody asked me the other night, I don't know whether he was kidding or not, saying, this was in Exeter, have you given any thought to doing stand-up comedy? And I don't know whether that was a compliment or not, But...
Well, you're an entertaining guy, so let's say it was a compliment.
I do bring to the subject several things. One of them is I worked on far-out propulsion systems, which gets to the heart of the question, can you get here from there or not? Mm-hmm. Second, I worked under security, so I know about keeping secrets and stuff. Third, as it turns out, for most of my life, I've had a very good memory, so I could give you an answer now. I don't say I'll get back to you tomorrow. This isn't a question and answer period. Fourth, people are willing to accept data, but what they really want to know is why. Why would aliens come here? Why doesn't the government tell us what it knows? Why don't they land on the White House lawn, stuff like that? And the usual response when I give my answers is, oh, I hadn't thought of it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Makes sense. So I'm playing to my strength. Now, there was a very important moment in my childhood. Fifth grade, Rose Gutkin was teaching us about science. And the sun stands still, and the planets move around the sun. Well, I just read, we were buying the encyclopedia one volume at a time from the supermarket. I think it was 49 cents a volume or something. This is a very long time ago. And I said, no, Miss Gutkin, I didn't sass teachers. I was an A student. I said, no, the whole solar system's moving around the galaxy at 12 miles a second, which seemed horribly fast to me, you know. No, that isn't right. She gave me a hard time. And I wasn't accustomed to somebody coming down hard. I mean, not a teacher. So the next day I brought in the volume of the encyclopedia. And she very reluctantly admitted, well, maybe that was right. But it taught me a lesson. If you're going to take on authority figures, have facts in hand before putting mouth in gear. Or they'll chop your head off, you know. So I've tried to stick by that. And other people who want to speak out, I say, look, there are a couple of basic rules. do your homework first. Never lie to an audience.
Okay.
You may get away with it for a while, but I don't think it's good policy. Stick to the fact. And don't be afraid to say, I don't know. Basic rules. So I have enjoyed being a performer, a stand-up, if you will. I've enjoyed doing radio and television. You know, there are times when you get upset about, well, it did Ted Koppel's Nightline. It was the, 40th anniversary of Kenneth Arnold's sighting. I was in Washington for a MUFON conference. And they had Phil Klass and I on. And we're going to be talking about government cover-up. Now, the show was a little shorter than it had to be because Jackie Gleason had died that day, so they had to spend a few minutes on him. But when we went in there, I've got a bunch of blacked-out documents. We're talking about government cover-up. See, mm-hmm. Here's the proof. Oh, you can't bring anything in. Why not? Well, that's not how we do things here. And you argue a little bit and you lose, you know. And then the circumstances. They put me facing a camera and Phil 2 feet away from me facing a camera. Don't look at each other. Now, how can you argue with somebody and not look at them? You know, I might as well be by radio, by phone, you know. And so we went at it. And people next day at the MUFON conference asked me, how did it go? I said, I don't know. You're on the show. I said, look, I don't know what you saw. I don't know what the audience saw. We each have a camera. Well, how was Ted? I don't know. I never saw him. Well, did you see him on a monitor? No. I heard him through my ear. Now, you denied all the nonverbal cues that you and I sitting here, I can see when you raise an eyebrow, you know,
right,
and stuff
right.
like that. It's a strange way to do stuff. And then you get the dishonest people. I get a call from a guy in California. Southern California. They're doing a show on abductions and they for Dick Clark. Now, if you can't trust Dick Clark, who can you trust, you know? And they'd done most of the show, but they needed to sharpen it up a little bit. Could I come out? And they'd ask me questions. And okay, I have a daughter in Southern California. I don't often get a chance to see her, so this would be a chance to see my daughter. Okay. And they asked me a whole bunch of questions. I gave them answers. They must have liked them because they used a lot of them on the show. What the show basically was, they had this cockamamie story that this family in Minnesota had encounters with aliens and had filmed it, and the film was found later. How exciting, you know. And they would have my comments. They'd ask about electromagnetic effects, and I would talk about them. Then they'd show something happening in the story. And I was used and abused, but good. And people came down on me. Oh, Stan, how could you get involved with that? And I said, well, you know, that's not the story I was told. Nobody asked me about that footage, but they cleverly intercut what I said with what was there. And
we'll try not to do that. We're talking with Stanton T. Friedman, and we'll try to be honest here in our approach.
Trust you, Jerry.
We're going to take a break, and we'll be back and wrap this up. I've got a big question for you, and that is basically, why did Jesse Marcel finally come clean, start talking about all this? We'll be right back. I'm Jerry Pippin. I don't know if you've noticed, probably most people have, when they come to jerrypippin.com. Sometimes you click on something and voila, you're at another website. We have two companion websites and they're designed specifically for specific use. iPodShows.net simply is all of our programming available as a podcast MP3. Don't worry, if you're one of those Windows PC people, we have links for that as well, even there on that site. Come and see us. All of our programming is on demand, and it's free, advertisers supported, 24/7.
You get anybody here have a question for Stanton Friedman?
Yes,
you want to ask him?
Yes, we
do. Okay. Let me get over there, and we'll do about 10 minutes.
Okay. Yeah. What was Ted Koppel like? I think he was in Tipmunk, too. No. Oh, no. It was about a family in Minnesota, the abduction of the McGriffin family or something like that. And, you know, they showed nice green grass in Minnesota in winter. You're not going to find it.
And that's Stanton T. Friedman going a little bit further about what Dick Clark Productions did to him. Another thing, Stanton, they did to you I thought was highly unfair was the Peter Jennings special.
Oh, boy.
And it appeared to me that there was two different specials going on there. The first part of that program looked pretty straightforward, and then somebody came in and talked to somebody or something.
Well, you know, that was a terrible experience, really.
It had to be.
Another one. I call it the Peter Jennings mockumentary. I mean, okay, I'm in Roswell. They want to talk to me. We go down to the art museum there. Nice art museum. Good setting. Guy asked me questions for over an hour. Good questions. This was a sensible, straightforward kind of discussion. I knew I was in trouble, though, when after we'd wrapped up, he said, Stan, don't you think if these things were real that half the academics and scientists would be working on UFOs? I said, absolutely not. Those who can do, those who can't teach. You know, and we talked about this earlier, that of course they wouldn't be going to academics. But we did over an hour interview. Turns out they interviewed 150 people. Only 50 of us made the cut. That included John Mack didn't make the cut. A whole bunch of PhDs, and I'll give you why I think they did this. But I got 20 seconds. They called me, and what was that word, an operator, twice. They said the witnesses just came out of the woodwork. You know, there was nothing to it. And I was really angry because one was a personal reason. I had thought I'd do better with Peter Jennings. I liked his work. I'd seen a program he did on the Catholic Church in old days, and I thought he did a fine job on it. Also, we're both born on July 29th, and we were both dual citizens of the United States and Canada. So I thought I ought to get a fair shake out of him, you know, if nothing else. I'd forgotten, I checked later, Benito Mussolini was also born on July 29th. But here's the kicker on this show. They had a lot of money. They spent a lot of money. They came to the MUFON conference. John Shushu set them up with a whole bunch of people. They didn't use any of it. They used Peter Davenport as if he was the only investigator in the country working on UFO stuff. Why do you interview 150 people for a two-hour show minus commercials? You know, that's not a lot of time. And so I have a conspiracy theory. Somebody said, how are we going to find out what these idiots in ufology know? Do they know anything useful? Are they going to expose us? Well, I know one way you could do it, says one of the guys. Give them a chance to be on a documentary with one of the big three news guys, you know, ABC, NBC, CBS. They all like to see their face on the tube. And so they arrange all these interviews. Like I say, 150. And, you know, as part of that, they asked me if I had any footage from television with me in it. I got loads of hunks of film, but I don't have time to go through that. Well, send it to us. We'll do it. I sent them 56 or 7 VHS tapes. They did send them back. What the hell did they do with all that stuff? There was some good stuff about Roswell on there, I'll tell you that. And so I thought it was disgraceful. That it really was. They attacked Roswell. They attacked abductions. They cut out most of what Bud Hopkins had said. They had Susan Clancy saying stupid things about why people think they were abducted, sleep paralysis and stuff like that. You know, Betty and Barney Hill were obviously sleeping when they were driving in New Hampshire. You know, just...
Stanton, it's always a pleasure having you on. Anything that we haven't covered we need to do?
No, I think... What is important right now is to realize how important for people on this planet to begin thinking of themselves as earthlings instead of all those nationalistic labels. Nationalism has got us in one heck of a lot of trouble. That's what the wars are about. I've got a great grandson. I'd like him to grow up in a more peaceful world than I've been fortunate enough to grow up in. And I think a big part of that is recognizing we're part of a galactic neighborhood, not just one country or one continent. And I'm hopeful. I'm an optimist still.
Thanks very much.
For the past month or so, we've been closing our show with a little bit of the Janus Concept CD. about abduction at Pascagoula. And we're going to do that again this week, of course. Charles Hickson and Calvin Parker's abduction into the spaceship is not much different than other stories that other people have told us here on the Jerry Pippin Show over the years. The only difference really is that Hickson and his memories are on tape. They were recorded shortly after it happened, while the memories were still fresh in his mind. Later, Parker would say that he could not remember what happened to him at all, but Hickson seemed to remember all of it quite vividly. Hickson wrote in a book about the experiences. He said that the aliens contacted him three other times after the original abduction there on the river by Pascagoula in January 1974 at a local tree farm. In February 1974 at his home, and on Mother's Day, 1977.
Well, when they did, I fell because my legs were weak and they gave way on me. And it was this time that I seen Calvin again. He was standing facing the river with his arms outstretched, and he was almost in shock. He seemed to appear to me at that time that something was wrong with him. So I was trying to make my way toward him, and I was crawling. I couldn't get my legs to working. But before I got to him, the strength of what it was came back to my legs, and I was getting up on my feet. And I heard the sound I'd heard before, a zipping sound. And I glanced around, and I saw the blue flashing lights, and it was, the crack was just gone, just almost instantly. And I made it to Calvin, and I shook him and was calling to him, and it took me several minutes to get him where I could even talk to him, you know, with any sense. And he seemed to be, when I seen him, he seemed to be going in shock. I've seen many men in shock in the Korean War, and he seemed to be going in shock, because it took me several minutes to even get him where I could talk to him to make any sense. Simply because the light was so bright that I just couldn't make out what it was. But I didn't see any tables or chairs, and the room seemed to be round. Of course, that could have been because the light seemed to be glowing from the walls and the overhead and the ceiling. But they carried me, about the middle of the room, and we would just seem to be suspended there. I couldn't move. I didn't have any feelings, no sensation of any feel. And it seemed something like a big eye. I keep referring to it as an eye because it was about the size of a small baseball. In the end, it was focused toward me with a different color or different light. And it seemed to come directly out from the wall, and it came within 6 or 8 inches of my face. And it remained there for a few minutes, and then it went over my entire body. I'm assuming it did, because when it went down like this, I seemed to be suspended there. And the next time I seen it, it was coming back up over this way. So I assumed that it went over my entire body. But it came back in front of my face and stayed there for a few more minutes, and then it came just go right back into the wall.
Thank you.
was segments of two cuts available in the concept CD by Janus called Abduction at Pascagoula. The cuts were Shock and Awe and Taken. If you'd like to order that CD, simply go over to our website, jerrypippin.com, and you'll see right underneath the highlights window a banner for Janus, and you click on it, and it's that easy. And you can get a download right away. This wraps up our show for this week. We'll be back next Monday night. Until then, thanks for listening. Cheers.